senator who, with John McCain, went to Vietnam to find out the truth about our POWs, and he wants to do something about health care and jobs in this country. He's not a bad man.
Mr. Melman, the vice president in August was asked at a town meeting by a voter this question. I'd like to know, sir, from your heart, I don't want to know what your advisors say or even what your top advisor thinks, but I need to know, what do you think about homosexual marriages? And this is how the vice president responded.
With respect to the question of gay marriage, Lynn and I have a gay daughter. So it's an issue that our family is very familiar with. We have two daughters, and we have enormous pride in both of them. They're both fine young women.
The vice president raised it, and then as Mr. Shrum said, October 5, John Edwards said, let me say, I think the vice president and his wife love their daughter. I think they love her very much. And the vice president said, let me simply thank the senator for the kind words he said about my family and our daughter. I appreciate that very much. If the vice president raised his daughter, and he thanks Senator Edwards for talking about her, why all this outrage now?
Well, Tim, I think it's pretty simple, and I think that, as you pointed out, most of the American people understand it, and that is, it's wrong to bring up the private life of a member of the vice president or president's family to make a political point. It's that simple.
Well, but wait a minute. Well, Vice President Cheney brought up his daughter's private life. When Senator Edwards brought it up, and by the way, she was a public figure because she was director of gay and lesbian affairs for the Coors Brewing Company. So when he brought it up, he said, thank you. So what's wrong with it? Senator Kerry obviously was trying to say something positive. You guys got killed in three debates. I walked into the spin room. Everybody thought you'd been killed. You were looking for something to say. That's what happened here.
Tim, I think fundamentally it's pretty simple. Again, you don't use the private lives of a member of the family for political purposes.
Then why did Dick Cheney mention the campaign? The campaign always talks about how they asked Bill Clinton for advice.
One of the things the Clintons did very well, I thought, was keep a zone of protection around the family.
Wait a minute, Mary Cheney is an official of the Bush campaign. Why did Dick Cheney mention his daughter's private life if it's inappropriate?
I think Dick Cheney was responding to a question.
Shut the hell up, you right-wing hacks, talking about how you don't bring up the private lives of family members in political debates. What the hell are you talking about? Karl Rove and company be bringing up the private lives of anyone they want to smash. They call Kerry a coward. They try to pretend, well, he was a coward, but they tried to pretend that even though he went around shooting up Vietnamese people for his imperial masters, he didn't do it with the Purple Heart integrity that Boy George, who was hiding out in Kansas, did it in. And then you have the nerve to not link it with the fact that Rove and company tried to discredit another campaigner who was running against Boy George at one time, saying that he had a black baby. What about that? The baby was just adopted from Bangladesh. Remember, Strom Thurmond had the black baby. I think you got it wrong. You know what time it is. Slave time. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, and radioforall.net, the universe, slave revolt time. Tonight we're going to jump into a Beyond the Shadow segment as we're going to deal with how liberals get caught up in this whole concept that it's just the way people use terms and imagery. That's the difference between the liberal view of the world and the conservative view. with Chomsky thrown in the mix and all of this nonsense. Then we're going to finish it up with what's really going on in America, a Klan museum. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Had you known him, you would have liked him. And maybe if you knew him, if you knew the other soldiers, you'd have thought differently about sending him. Sherwood was a foster kid and he came to our family before I was born. He had limited contact with his biological family. Our parents never let him go. They received him, raised him, and he was their child. He was their son and my brother. In so many ways, Sherwood represented the country he loved. He was dealt a tough hand and turned it into inspired opportunity, always struggling between optimism and reality. He seemed to be on a lifelong quest to codify a family. When he became a father at 21, he embraced the role with enviable enthusiasm. He joined the Army National Guard in Wilkes-Barre. He wanted to help his community, wanted to support his wife and his son, and wanted to pay off his college loans. He discovered brotherhood in the Army as well. Now he was a part of one more family. He found it whenever he sat and talked. I can certainly find things about him that you would appreciate. I know you're familiar with fabrications. You remember the things you said about the weapons and the terrorist ties? Well, he wasn't as good as you, but listen to him. He told us he'd be okay. He'd return safe, and we'd see him soon. And check this out. He was a C student, too. When he was called up, I told him that if he wanted to get out of guard duty, he, too, could apply to Harvard Business School. Sherwood just laughed. You made him laugh. Yet still, he went to fight in your war. He never wavered, never cried, never expressed a desire to somehow get out of this mess. He went because he knew responsibility. He knew it as well as he knew how irresponsible you had been for sending him. He had honor and he had pride. Sherwood had commitment to his country, to his job, and to his unit. Maybe not so much to his commander-in-chief, quite honestly, but that's probably because he didn't know you, because you didn't sit down with him. You just sent him a letter and a plane ticket to Baghdad. I heard that you have yet to attend the funeral of a fallen soldier. I, too, had never been to a soldier's funeral before Tuesday. I fully understand why you're ducking it. It's tough. I heard that Sherwood lived 2 hours after he was struck in an explosion. Long enough, I hope, to make his peace with everybody he called family. But I can't say for sure if he made peace with you. He didn't know you. Sherwood is in a grave now, and there's a folded flag in his wife's arms. He's at rest, but he'd be happy to listen to what you have to say. Even now, you can still help him to make peace. You said we need to finish the work of the fallen. You may be surprised to know that the real work he started was not in Iraq. Sherwood's work is here. Mr. President, I want you to look into the eyes of his 9-year-old son and see his unfinished work. Feel free to get back to me. We ought to talk. You won't have a problem finding me. I stick out in the crowd these days. I'm the proud little brother of Sergeant Sherwood Baker. With hope, Dante Zavala.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what we're going to deal with on a Beyond the Shadow segment is, there's this guy running around named George Lakoff. He's some little liberal out of Berkeley. And we're going to deal with the world of liberal ideology, in a sense. This is an author of a book called... Moral Politics. And he was recently on Talk of the Nation with Neil Cohen. And he got into a discussion about how basically liberals are right with their viewpoint of the world and conservatives are right. It's just the method that they use makes them feel that they're on polar opposites. The reality is that, in a sense, he's right. They are on the same side, the side of the big capitalists. But we're going to deal with how this stuff is perpetuated in this society. As they start off talking about how there's an aspect of understanding liberals and conservatives through the concept of the metaphor of the family. So let's see what these guys have to say, and then we'll take it beyond the shadow. Check this out.
Liberals, for example, find it hard to understand how conservatives can support the death penalty and oppose abortion at the same time. Conservatives fail to see how liberals can paint themselves as champions of labor when they support environmental regulations that limit the creation of new jobs. At some point, people on both sides throw up their hands and say, "My position is plain common sense, and you just don't get it." George Lakoff argues that both of them are right. What divides red state, blue state, 50-50 America, he says, are fundamentally different worldviews that explain why conservatives tend to agree on a wide variety of seemingly disparate issues, from taxes to school vouchers, and why liberals take the opposite tack. So why are you a liberal or a conservative, or maybe a maverick? Did you choose one philosophy over the other, or do you decide by issue by issue? What are the underlying principles that make liberals liberals and conservatives conservatives? Why do the two sides have so much trouble understanding each other? Our number here in Washington, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. George Lakoff is a cognitive scientist and professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He explains his theories in a book called Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think, first published in 1996, out again in 2002. He joins us now from the studios at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Good of you to join us on Talk to the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You write that the most important tool to understanding these differences is to understand metaphors, and that the most important metaphor is the family.
Yes. When you try to understand why it is that all of the different positions hold together, why it is that the same people who favor abortion also favor lower taxes, also favor the ownership of guns and so on. What do they fit together? And why do people who have exactly the opposite positions, what do they fit together? What explains it is a metaphorical understanding of the nation as a family. We have our founding fathers. We send their sons and daughters to war. We hear these expressions and never think twice about them, but we do understand the nation as a family. But what's interesting is that there are two different kinds of families. What I call a strict father family and a nurturing parent family. And when you understand the differences, and that these metaphors of nature, nation as family map those things onto the nation, what you understand is that there are two utterly different understandings of our politics that come out of these family views. The strict father family begins with a set of assumptions. The world is a dangerous and difficult place. There's competition. There will always be winners and losers. Children are born bad. That is, they want to do just what they want to do, not what is right. And that they need to be made good. You need a strict father, according to this view, because you need someone who will protect the family in the dangerous world, support it in the difficult world, win those competitions, and teach his children right from wrong. And the assumption is there is an absolute right and absolute wrong, and there's only one way to teach kids right from wrong, and that is punishment. Painful punishment, which can be either physical punishment or withdrawal of affection. The result of this is the following, that the assumption is children will develop discipline through being punished when they do wrong. That is, they'll learn to discipline themselves internally, and that this moral discipline will result in a discipline to get them through in the world, to seek their self-interest and become self-reliant and prosperous.
And to themselves and then go on to raise, and themselves to go on and raise, the stern fathers themselves.
Exactly. And not only that, there's a link between morality and prosperity as a result. And so you see the idea that if you're not prosperous, you're not disciplined, and if you're not disciplined, you're probably not moral, and so you deserve not to be prosperous. You deserve your poverty.
And the other...
The result is that you go against social programs. You think all social programs are immoral because they give people things that they don't want. I mean, that that they haven't earned. And the result of that, if they haven't earned it, is dependence. The result of that is that people become less and less disciplined, and therefore you hurt the people you're trying to help. That's the conservative argument.
Now, what's kind of sick about all of this is, first, you know, they start off with how Lakoff has positioned is that it's just two different worldviews based off of the family model. The strict father, which is the conservative one, and then you'll hear the liberal version of one. But that both views are right. Now, even though both views don't address the class nature of the world and how both conservative and liberal views and ideologies within the context of capitalism have helped destroy much of the regions of the world and turn it into a giant Indian reservation, because both views are in alignment with the ruling class and its hierarchical structure. That's who their strict father figure is, both of them, both liberals and conservatives, the ruling class, and that's who they bow down to. Getting into all this other, you know, hocus pocus stuff, you know. So then Lakoff goes into, you know, some of these things are a contradiction. How some people could be like conservatives could be abortion, but at the same time pro gun. Pro gun within the context of a conservative or a liberal has nothing to do with freedom. As the conservative author of some of the wretched 1968 gun control acts, and these were gun control acts that they got from the 1934 Nazi gun control act, and basically were influenced by what Hitler had gun control laws that he had used to basically persecute communists, gypsies, Jews, stuff like that. In other words, his disposable people. And Hitler was influenced by the black codes in the 1800s, which were used in a fascistic type of way to basically brutalize black people and help subjugate them by force on the plantation. In 68, this conservative author said that gun control laws are not designed to control guns. They're designed to control blacks. So a conservative yapping about freedom, you know, the Second Amendment, that's this Orwellian doublespeak. They're not talking about all segments of the society. They're talking about this in a way that means how to maintain their version of freedom, they must use violence and the laws to help perpetuate violence against their disposable, quote-unquote, populations. So when Lakoff goes into all of this, the strict father family, you know, realizes or views the world as winners and losers, and that the world is a dangerous place, and, you know, that one must develop discipline. You know, a while back, listeners should check out the whole Slave Revolt show, or a segment of the Slave Revolt show that I did, basically based on what's called hard imperialism and soft imperialism. And basically, the hard imperialists, which are generally conservatives, have this kind of macho, go it alone, you know, John Wayne-ish approach. It's all cowardly because they're just beating up mainly defenseless third world people in Panama and Haiti, you know. But the soft imperialists are like the Kerry types, who are still pro-imperialists, but they want to consult with other capitalist empires and countries more readily to get a consensus on who to cowardly go beat up on. So that's the soft imperialism approach of the liberals and the hard imperialism approach. And they use all of these sound bite words, you know, the world's a dangerous place and all of that. They've always been saying that. They were saying that as they were expanding upon on Indian territory, that the world is a dangerous place. I.e., we're encroaching on some Indians' land and committing genocide against them, and they don't like it. So it's gotten dangerous for us. So we must massacre them all. Without examining why the world or segments of populations become hostile to you because of what you're implementing against their basic human rights, it's basically this mystical talk in the air. So within these sound bites, they can go into this how the strict father figure, i.e. conservative, believes that there must be discipline, and people who do not have discipline deserve their poverty. Look, black people who were enslaved by this wretched society were the most disciplined people in this wretched country, along with the Native Americans. Our discipline and survival skills had nothing to do with our poverty. The slave trade did, and the enforcement of it did. This is all hocus pocus talk. But at the same time, when one talks about who does and does not deserve poverty, and this is why they're against social welfare programs, the biggest welfare constituents is corporate welfare. So here are all of these people who, you know, quote unquote conservatives back, and this guy is not examining their own contradiction. He's just going off of these soundbite platitude words without going into the fact that corporate crime, you have a higher chance of being killed in the workplace because of corporate neglect and crime than you do on the streets of America. So if people who are involved in criminal activity do not deserve any kind of sympathy because they're undisciplined and on the streets and, you know, they're malnourished because, you know, they're on welfare or whatever, how does one conservative address the fact that the highest, it's almost twice as high, of the people who are killed illegally, you know, in some unlawful way, twice as many people are killed through a corporate neglect and crime than just the little street crime stuff that goes on? How does he address the fact that just a couple of years ago you had the Dying Corps slaves? Here's this little corporation, you know, in Bosnia. Sam puts his who's over in Bosnia. The corporations come over there basically to feed off the trough and off the blood and soul of the people in the same way that Halliburton's doing it in Iraq. And here these corporate execs, after they're there for a while, they decide that they're going to buy them up a couple of little 12 and 13-year-old girls as slaves, sex slaves. Then they buy themselves brothels. And then this carry on in this little sick feast, like they're in Rome or something. One employee is so sickened by this that he breaks out the story, and this is how it all comes out. Now, if this had been some NBA basketball players over in, you know, at the little in Greece in the Olympics, and had, you know, some underage girls that they were paying to, you know, do all this stuff too, you wouldn't. They still be talking about it. The wretchedness of black folks' soul, the deprived and poverty of a culture, and on and on and on. But when you have these henchmen and these corporations riding around doing things that are more insidious than any barbarian in the history and the annals of world history, these clowns and their strict father figure that this little lightweight liberal is trying to cover up for, he has nothing to say about it.
Whenever you see a liberal going on about morals, you got to hurry up and put your hand over your wallet. I've heard this man...
Or put your hand on your gun.
I've heard this man speak about his little book. I didn't read the book, but I can tell you this. Keep this in your mind, fellow workers. The truth is never abstract. The truth is always concrete. So he can have his little analogies and metaphors, but when they bring it on down to Soulsville, what is he really saying? All told, I think we got him.
All right, now next, Lakoff goes into the liberal family structure and argument. So let's see what Lakoff has to say next. Check this out.
Now, the liberal way of raising families is the following. They have a nurturing family, and they assume that both parents are necessary and equal, and that their job is to nurture their children and raise their children to be nurturers of others. Nurturers of others is very important. In addition, nurturance has two things about it. First, empathy. You have to know what all those cries of the baby mean. You have to be able to connect with your children. And responsibility. You have to be able to take care of yourself if you're going to take care of others, and you have to be responsible for others. And you're teaching your children to be empathetic and responsible toward others as well. From these two values, empathy and responsibility, a great deal follows, namely all of the progressive principles. So, for example, if you empathize with your child, you want to protect your child, and therefore you have political principles of protection like worker protection, consumer protection, environmental protection. If you care about your child, you want your child to be fulfilled in life, and so fulfillment becomes an important value, and there's no fulfillment without freedom. You have to be free to fulfill yourself, and that's why liberty and pursuit of happiness go together. Similarly, a child can't be fulfilled if he's treated unfairly, so fairness is a value. There's no freedom without opportunity, and no opportunity without prosperity, so opportunity and prosperity become values. And you don't live alone. As Hillary Clinton says, it takes a village. You live in a community. So community building and community maintenance and service to that community become values, and you can't have that without cooperation. So cooperation is a major value, together with what is required for cooperation: trust. No trust without honesty and open communication. So cooperation, trust, honesty, and open communication are progressive values. All of these values are the progressive moral system. That is why progressives believe what they believe, and they often run up against conservatives.
Now here we go again. So now he's given the liberal family structure argument. But once again, he's getting into this hocus pocus arena, because he goes how liberals raise their families to be nurturers of others. You know, you've had one liberal along with conservatives after another, but we're talking about liberals now, who've been in administrations, who've been in powers of government. They've all goose-stepped along with the School of the Americas and the 200 other plus like School of the Americas, which are schools straight out of hell, industries that are there to basically help teach the art of covert destruction, genocide, and war to whatever Latin, mainly henchmen like Noriega, Hugo Zan, Benzier, Suarez, so that they can go back to their respective countries and beat down their prospective people so that the population will be docilized and receptive to low-wage, high-repression systems that will come in the name of Nike, Levi Strauss, Reeboks, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, liberals support this model. So how could you be a nurturer if you support the School of the Americas, which they do? If you support the IMF and World Bank policies, which they do, which are structurally adjusting people down into deprivation. So to get into all of this liberal, you know, nurture model and stuff, what are they doing? They're nurturing biological weaponry at a rate that no other country in the world has. They're nurturing nuclear weaponry and have been the only country to drop the atomic bomb on another country at a rate that no other country ever has, on and on. And then he says that liberals, therefore, also because of their whole nurture concept, have close ties and believe in worker protection, consumer protection, environmental protection. Look, what he wants you to do is be anti-history and ahistorical. Because the fact of the matter is that all of these particular gains that we do have in this country has been by militant working class struggle that it's had to fight against liberal presidents, conservative presidents, and politicians on down the line. These gains that workers got weren't because some liberal came in with some kind of philosophy that we're all in this together and stuff. There was militant class struggle going on in the 30s and stuff that got, you know, 40-hour work week and child labor laws. These raggedy liberals were just as much against it as their conservative counterparts because the ruling class in this society was against it. And that's their family. That's the family structure that they live within and the strict father figure that they abide by. So he's counting on and promoting people to be ahistorical. So to get in, so he says, you know, liberals support truth and honesty and, you know, fairness values and things like that. You know, and people who they often bring to mind or say when they talk about this stuff are people like, you know, the Bay of Pigs, President JFK. You know, and that's all you have to think about with JFK, or one of the things, you know, honesty model, the Bay of Pigs, the covert actions, his little brother assigning the FBI to wiretap people's phones and to follow them around like a king. That's the honesty model. You know, it was Kennedy who set up these various programs that were like Peace Corps and all of that. And he set them up so that young, bright-eyed, kids of that time would go off to places like Africa, which were decolonializing, so that this would be the image that Africans had on American people, you know, the little bright-eyed Peace Corps type kids digging wells for poor, starving, quote-unquote, Africans. Never mind the fact that, as John Stockwell would later know, that who was in the CIA and wrote the landmark book In Search of Enemies, that it was basically CIA agents that would come right along after the wells were built and throw poison in it. So while here you got these one guys putting on this artificial face for Sam, which is basically what Lakoff is doing. He's putting on an artificial face for liberals, an artificial face for conservatives. You have the real people beyond or within the shadow creating all of this havoc and mayhem for much of the planet, for you know who.
Yeah, well, you know, just to mention, since you mentioned Kennedy, Tracy, there's a film, and I don't know if this has been integrated into a movie, but there was a film of John F. Kennedy addressing five thousand Gusanos in Florida. just before the Bay of Pigs. And if you had seen this liberal speaking in this situation, it might have shed you from some of your illusions. I can say that. Now, because he was real, he was calling for like blood, you know.
But see, that's what I mean by Lakoff wants you to be ahistorical stuff like that, because then they can soundbite you into these gumpified phraseologies of what liberals are supposed to stand for. Don't look at the facts. What conservatives are supposed to stand for. So imagery is thrown around instead of the hardcore facts and reality.
So let's look at this history a minute. Liberalism as an ideology, if you want to call it that, actually didn't come to be until capitalism came to be. That's when it actually began. And another term, and the reason it did is because liberalism always stood between revolutionary action on one hand by revolutionary Democrats and the working class, and the monarchists. See, so the liberals were always for half measures. We don't want to be insurgents. We don't want to overthrow. We don't want all this violence. But we do need some changes. So we'll just bring them in nice.
And this is what we basically have been hearing from, you know, like Neil Cohen, Jeff Cohen, you know, all this lesser of two evil concepts, and, you know, Michael Parente and all of these guys. I mean, this is slave revolt. It's the real world.
That's right. You know? That's right. In fact, there's a beautiful little song written about liberals, written by a guy named Phil Oakes. It's called "Love Me, Love Me, Love Me. I'm a Liberal." I recommend y'all check that out. And that'll help, you know, like just get rid of any little remnant of illusion that might have been around after this broadcast.
Now, next, Neil Cohen, host of the NPR show Talk of the Nation, ask about what most of the people thinking and how they think unconsciously and in metaphors. So let's see what Lakoff has to say, and we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Now, the heart of this is the idea of this unconscious metaphor. Not, you point out, not unconscious in the Freudian sense, but unconscious in the sense that we just don't think about it.
Right. Most of our thought, as cognitive science shows, is unconscious. I mean, almost all of it. And certainly the concepts that we use, the ideas we use, and so on, are almost all unconscious. They're things we just don't even notice or think about until someone points them out to us. And so our job as cognitive scientists is to figure out how people actually think and how that works. One of the most important things that we've discovered is that people first think metaphorically, and second, they think in terms of what are called conceptual frames, that is, small little bundles of ideas that are coherent and about one thing. For example, if you take the notion of tax relief, which came into our parlance through George Bush when he took office, take the word relief. Relief is defined relative to what is called a conceptual frame. For there to be relief, there has to be an affliction, an afflicted party who's harmed by it, a reliever who takes the affliction away, who's a hero, and if anybody tries to stop them, they're a bad guy. You add tax to that, and you get taxation as an affliction, which is a conservative idea that goes along with the idea that people who are disciplined should pursue their self-interest, become prosperous. Their money is their reward, and taxation is something that takes that reward away.
So once again, you have Lakoff going on into this whole bit about how people think in conceptual frames, and how they think in various forms of metaphors and all of that type of stuff. And while there's an element of truth, it's not like all, you know, the thing is that if you live in a society where they're intentionally trying to grind you in just to primarily think that way, then you become susceptible to being disillusioned and confused about what steps are needed to get you off of the plantation and to kill the slave master. So this basically is how sound bites are used and played intentionally to gumpify down the population. And the fact of the matter is that liberals like himself play into this stuff, because it was all of these raggedy liberals who had been neck deep in trying to get someone who's basically just another form of a liberal, Nader, from entering into the debates. So they perpetuate how closed and maintained the sphere of debates are, and on what level they should be on. So you got one guy who's saying that, you know, we must proceed and go on in this war in Iraq, and I know I've done the right thing because my invisible man told me so, and so on and so forth. And then you got another clown on the other end saying, we will complete this war, but my only concern is that we should not have gone it alone, and it was at the wrong place at the wrong time, but we will finish this off, and to make sure, I will add 40,000 more troops. So you have a limited range if you're confused enough to get into these types of debates, or confused enough to get into voting for, those who are going to be administrators for the ruling class, about what should be and should not be done and how you should look at it. So, of course, these guys are going to use tricknology words like tax relief, to ask, you know, like it's a relief on someone. Of course. But if there is no analytical understanding and critiquing about, does this serve a particular people's interest, a particular class interest, then of course, then you're confused. Just like you may be on gun control. It served the ruler's class in the 1800s to implement in gun control, because they were able to unleash more terror in the name of gun control on their desired population, the black population. And terrorist squads grew up in the midst of all that, the Klan. Now, did that control the Klan? Nah, because it wasn't designed. This is Orwellian talk. But see, that's what he wants you basically to do. Get caught up in these metaphors and, you know, concept frames. That way you can better understand your conservative or liberal enemy. Not want to crush them into the ground. Just understand them. See where your neighbor's coming from. Now, get the hell out of here. I know where Halliburton's coming from. I see it every day. We can see it within our communities. I know where the police are coming from. The 21-year-old woman who got shot in the eye by a non-lethal projection, right? You know, in Boston, after celebrating the Boston victory over the Yankees, she gets blasted in the eye with a non-lethal projection. She saw where the police, at least with one good eye, were coming from as she collapsed in death. So let's not get caught up in the hocus-pocus rhetoric that Lakoff is trying to use. Now, next, Neil Cohen and Lakoff go into how these concepts and philosophies are consistent. Let's see how consistent these philosophies are. Check this out.
And these, you argue, establish two coherent political philosophies that are internally consistent, even when, from the other side, it seems like an apparent contradiction.
That's correct. Each of these philosophies is internally consistent. And each makes sense. In fact, they define what common sense is. That is, your view of what morality consists of and your view of how to frame things defines common sense. They're physically in your brain. You can't change them. Now, what's particularly interesting about this is that we all have both versions of this, either actively or passively. If you are a liberal in every part of your life, but you go to an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie or a John Wayne movie and you understand it, then you have a strict father model, at least passively, used for understanding, but not necessarily for living. Many people, and similarly for the other side, many people have both models active in different parts of their lives. So, for example, a Reagan Democrat is someone, say, who's a blue-collar worker, who's a strict father at home, but nurturant in his union politics or on the job.
So as you go through this, you're also a linguist, as we pointed out. You point out that people use different words, that literally both sides are talking different languages.
Sure. Take an example from the Republican convention. You had Zell Miller saying that George Bush had a spine of tempered steel. What is that about? Why a spine of tempered steel? Well, the idea is that a strict father has to be morally strong, internally strong, and that character is defined by this internal strength. That's the spine of tempered steel. What's the opposite of that? That someone who doesn't have such a spine, a flip-flopper, whose spine, you know, doesn't stand up, but goes back and forth from one side to another. So that the flip-flopper charge is actually a very deep charge to anybody who has a strict father model. It's not a matter of just going from one position to another. It's a matter of not having that spine of tempered steel, that internal moral strength.
It's a matter, they would say, of character.
They would call it character. Their notion of character is internal moral strength, whereas the notion of character for progressives is caring and responsibility.
All right, here we go again. You have a situation where, part of the game plan, in part, of this particular liberal, and they all do it to a certain degree because they need each other. When he says liberal ideology and conservative ideology are internally consistent, you must recognize that this is just an enemy who's trying to legitimize the various structures that support the capitalist system. And he does not want you to go outside of that particular box.
Right.
So he's saying we're both legit. Don't think as angry if you're a liberal at the conservatives. And if you're a conservative, don't think that the liberal's the worst thing on the planet. Because we're both right. We just have different models of how we're looking at the world. Meanwhile, they both hold hands in hands as they demolish Chile, both liberals and conservatives, in the original 9/11 hit in 1973, without any form of contradiction whatsoever. And a strict father can say, hey, look, you know, we must have discipline and, you know, and all of that. And the liberal can, you know, use platitudes of how we work together with other imperialists in spying on our enemies before we went and crushed them and stuff. You know, then he starts getting into this abstract stuff, which is where he wants to keep you, saying nonsense like, you know, if you go to an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, you know, and since Arnold's a conservative, you know, a little, that, you know, this means you have elements of the strict father model. What the hell are you talking about? Arnold was an actor. He did scripts and stuff. Look, in Terminator, he played a robot.
That's right.
Which is an element of truth when it comes to you conservatives and liberals, because you are robots to the ruling class. But John Wayne, another quote-unquote strict father model, right? You know, with moral strength and integrity. He was a draft dodger. He kept his ass out of that war. what character are you talking about? It was all in celluloid. It was pretend. I mean, this is silly. But he wants you to stay silly. Yeah, he wants to keep you silly. And just get into all of this nonsense about liberals caring about responsibilities, you know, but they have a moral look on that whole thing in a community type way, and on and on and on and on. When the 60s rolled in and groups like the Panthers were being attacked, it was liberals and conservatives passing legislation, arming the FBI and the police with COINTEL programs to smash up by any means the Panther and other organizations of the day. There was no sense of caring about the community and what impact this would have. This was about class warfare. That's what they're about. That's all, in essence, they're about, in trying to redefine your reality to think in some other way.
Now, you know, the first thing you're going to see, fellow workers, when you see this kind of interview, you know it's going to stink. Put your hand over your wallet. What kind of interview is this when the interviewer actually just reads parts of the book to him and says, oh, this is great? And he reads something to the guy, and the guy says, yes. And what I mean by that is, where's the skepticism? An interviewer is supposed to challenge the person that they are interviewing. Push the envelope. Check out those boundaries. Try to see what's really going on. Demand answers. This is an interview. What the hell is this BS?
Well, see, the way things are set up in the corporate media structure, their challenge is basically, you know, for those in the corporate media, their main challenge is to gumpify the masses. Mm. So he teams up basically with Lathoff.
Yeah.
Because he agrees.
Yes.
That we should not look at these things in a class conflict way. That basically a conservative is your brother. And the liberals, your brother, they just have different roots of understanding. Strict father model, nurture father model. Meanwhile, they're helping perpetuate genocide all over the planet.
Blam, blam. You know what? This is the new credo of the liberal. And that's why we can very carefully say this reconciliation with conservatism is really nothing new. In every serious crisis that we have ever seen, be it the rise of fascism, world war, Russian Revolution, the liberal always runs to the conservative for help. It's not new. And you know what? It signals, though, it's getting a little gross, and you know, lately. So what we start to see, why is it so gross? Why is it so obviously, you know, just strange? It's because capitalism is dying. And that's why they got to come up with these ridiculous... This is embarrassing, to tell you the truth. To put this on the air?
What should be embarrassing is how much many of these KPFA types have been lavishing all over it. I've been hearing I've been hearing it on those various different shows.
Yeah, Morning Show. That's where I heard him.
More on those particular KPFA shows than I have on NPR. And they've been singing the praise and holding him up on his shoulder like he was, you know, Thor with...
No doubt.
With the concept of enlightenment in a jar, you know.
No doubt.
So,
you've been on that Morning Show a number of times. That's right.
Next, Neil Cohen asked Lakoff about moral accounting. Let's see what Lakoff has to say next.
Another metaphor that plays an enormous role in your theory is that of moral accounting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's a major metaphor for morality. Let me give you an example. Suppose I do something good for you. You say, gee, I'm in your debt. I owe you one. How can I ever repay you? It's as if doing something good for you. Giving you a favor is like giving you money, and then you owe me something back. Now, if I do something bad to you, how are the books balanced? Well, there are three ways. I can do something good to make up for it. That's restitution. You can do something bad back to me. That's retribution. Or, by moral arithmetic, you can take something good away from me, which is revenge. Those are the standard ways of doing moral accounting. Of course, there's turning the other cheek, which is the classic Christian way to deal with this, which means that, harm me again, and then you owe me twice. So that imposes guilt. Guilt has to do with the notion of moral debt.
And I wonder, we just have a minute or so left before we have to go to a break, and we will get to your calls after a break, 800-989-8255. But this idea of, this account, how old is it? I mean, money isn't really that old in terms of human culture.
It goes back, it's not just money, but property of any kind, anything that you own or have. So it's not just property. There's trade, and trade goes back as far as you go. Moral accounting goes back as far as recorded history goes, and the basic metaphors for morality do too. If you look at the division between strict father and nurturing parents, that is ancient as well. It goes back to different interpretations of religion. There are in each religion a strict version and a nurturing version, and they go back thousands of years. And within European history, you get both versions of both religion and the politics.
All right, now, the fact that he's throwing out this moral accounting concept is another grand illusion game, because in essence he's trying to say that liberals and conservatives are morally accountable. The reality is how morally accountable were any of these particular fractions during like the Civil War? You had a situation where strict father conservative elements in the South saw that they were losing the war and were going to lose that Civil War, morally say, well, it just looks like we're going to lose this war, but let's hold our heads up high and die with dignity in the way they portray them on these little TV shows? Of course not. They started to commit terrorism. R.C. Kennedy was one of the lead terrorists who, a little Southern hick who comes over to the North, to New York in particular, and proceeds to try to burn up all of New York with Greek chemical, along with his other Confederate terrorist allies. They set out on about 9 different hotels and stuff and throw this Greek chemical solution in these different hotels that they had rented out to engulf the whole city in flames. They weren't attacking the army. They were trying to demoralize the North and to demoralize and terrorize the population at hand. Meanwhile, other Confederates were consigned to develop coal bombs. The industrial society was basically ran off coal at the time. So these terrorists decided to make bombs that looked like coal and spread it throughout the North in ships and factories to just blow up anyone who happens to be there, a la Bin Laden style. They also decided to use biological warfare in the name of yellow fever. So they went over to where all of these people had gotten sick and died from yellow fever, got their clothes, stripped it off of them, and started sending it to the North. They even sent some to the White House to try to get old Abe. So biological warfare in the form of yellow fever. Chemical warfare in the name of Greek fire. and on down the line. And this your own a home brand form of warfare in the name of coal bombs and stuff. You know, your collateral damage type of warfare. This is what these clowns were doing. They're not morally accountable. They're trying to win. That's the game plan. There's no way anyone in their right mind can justify what I just outlined and have outlined in a commentary on this whole thing during the Civil War, how R.C. Kennedy and all these Confederates were basically using terroristic tactics against the population. The only reason why the burning of New York didn't secede, it wasn't because they didn't have it outlined in various locations, you know, correctly and stuff, but they didn't realize that they needed to open up the windows in the rooms where they threw the Greek fire, because this chemical fire needs air to really go up in a big flame in a rapid way. So even though it smoldered and caught on fire, people were able to put it out, and the fire departments weren't overwhelmed like other Confederates, including Jefferson Davis, who gave them money to do this stuff, hoped it would. Now, in the same way that you won't see a conservative write do a movie on the stuff I just outlined, is the same way you won't see Lakoff break down these types of real factual stuff that have gone on, because they both are serving each other and spreading an illusion about the way this wretched society works. And that as long as you think in metaphors and imagery, and Boy George is an honest man and sincere because he bends his knees to some invisible man in the sky and on and on, this is what all these clowns perpetuate. That's their game plan. You know, this whole concept of looking at this moral accountable type of phraseology that he uses is the same thing that hocus pocus people of all these different faiths, the Abrahamic tradition, Islam's, Christians, and Hebrons, want you to get caught up in, so that they can be killing up populations in the name of their tradition. They're doing it with a turban on. You know, they're Christopher Columbus with a turban on, like in the Sudan, you know. Or Christopher Columbus. Yeah, as a matter of fact, this whole turn-the-cheek Christian tradition.
Oh, man.
Was Christopher Columbus turning his cheek? He was chopping off heads. He was turning his cheek to look what Indian he was going to chop a head off next. This is ridiculous. But that's the game plan.
That ought to be embarrassing for any American to talk that turn-the-other-cheek shit. And you killing up troops in how many countries of the world right now?
And bases there to get prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to show you how this whole concept can this corrode, you know, last week I did a show on Howard Zinn, you know, and showed how he zigzagged around and basically was justifying pulling the lever for Kerry too, you know. So here's a historian who, since he's so broken down and demoralized, he doesn't even use what's supposed to be the basis of his repertoire, history, to analyze the reality on the ground. But to show that this stuff knows no bounds in these types of traditions, next is Noam Chomsky. And here Chomsky Ferris outlines on the Amy Goodman show how the elections are a sham, but
yes.
Check this out.
Population has been very carefully excluded from the political arena and the general culture, the general dominant culture. That's not by accident. I mean, an enormous amount of work went into this. Elites were terrified by the 60s. And there's this outburst of popular participation, democracy, and so on. And there's a huge counter campaign to drive it back. It shows up in all kinds of ways. I mean, from what's called neoliberalism, financial system, to freeing financial flows, which is well understood, is a weapon against allowing governments to make choices, a weapon against democracy. From that to the huge explosion of lobbyists in Washington, to the right-wing think tanks, to the just everything you think of across the board has been an effort to drive that danger of democracy back into the whole where it belongs.
Yet the person who points that out, Ralph Nader, you and Howard Zinn and others, to many people's surprise, signed a letter and said, don't vote for him. And
we didn't say that. Actually, I'm a little surprised by the surprise. I took exactly the position I took in 2000. Namely, look, the election is a marginal affair. It should not distract us from the serious work of changing the society and the culture and the institutions and creating a democratic culture. That's what you work on. You can't ignore the election. It's there. But it's designed as a method of essentially marginalizing the population. There's a huge propaganda campaign to get people to focus on these personalized extravaganzas and make them think that's politics. Well, it isn't. That's a marginal part of politics, and you're a very marginal part. So the main thing is keep on with your work. You can't ignore it. You should spend 5 minutes maybe thinking about what you should do. And in that 5 minutes, you should recognize that there is some difference between the two groups contending for power. And one of them happens to be really extremist and very dangerous, and has already caused plenty of trouble and could cause plenty more. The other is bad, but less extremist and less dangerous. So in that 5 minutes that you devote to this topic, you should come to the rational conclusion. If it's a swing state, keep the worst guys out. If it's another state, do what you feel like. The same thing as in 2000 during the 5 minutes of time I spent on.
Ralph Nader said at least a demand should have been attached to this.
To what? To who? A demand to who? I mean, I don't address George Bush. I don't make demands of him. Donald Rumsfeld is not my audience. I don't talk to Sandy Berger.
To John Kerry, if you were throwing your
sword. I don't talk to John Kerry. I mean, he is not my audience or your audience or our audience. We can't make demands on them. I mean, some people can. Like Pat Robertson recently said that unless they do, I know, take an even more extreme position supporting Israeli expansion, he'll set up a third party, which could, that's a real threat. I mean, he could draw, you know, tens of millions of evangelical Christians out of the Republican Party. Okay, he can make a demand. So they'll say thank you and throw him a little red meat and then go on doing exactly what they were doing. But we don't have that constituency. We can't make demands. I mean, the demands, that this is meaningless. It's a misunderstanding of the way politics works. We should create a situation in which popular organizations will be able to make demands. Not me, not you, but popular organizations. They'll be able to make demands and press them. That's what we should be working on.
Okay, now, this is, woo, it never ends. Here you have a situation where Chomsky goes into this whole thing about, first he starts talking about how the population has been excluded from politics. And this is not a coincidence. Realizing that the Democrats, along with the Republicans, have played a role in this type of stuff, quite rightly, in things. There's a lot of hard facts to back this up. You know, historically, when the class struggle was going on strong, you even had big businessmen talk about the people need to be concerned, the masses, the people need to be concerned with religion, not issues of class and money. You know, which, right now they got it working pretty well for them. But then, after breaking down these various things about how the election is a marginal affair and so on and so forth, and it should not distract us, you know, then he goes into, though, that you should spend 5 minutes on it, which is what the average liberal wants you to do. Think, in a sense, within the framework of Lakoff, metaphorically and all, not scientifically, not analytically. Only spend 5 minutes on it, and then cast your vote and recognize that there is some difference, and one's less extreme than the other. Well, if you're only going to spend that short amount of time on something that those who believe in this whole voting process is so crucial, then why even do this, go through the process? But caught with this contradiction, when Amy asked him about why he signed these papers for Nader not to be involved in the electoral process, a process that he himself was condemning Democrats and Republicans of condensing down into basically an affair that's basically a joke, caught with the fact that he participated in this by trying to exclude another liberal, or at least signing a paper for another liberal type not to get involved, he starts to get all, you know, bent out of shape and tries to twist it around and this do what's in your best interest. Amy then brings out the fact that, and she brought this out the Zinzag, where I played last week, that and Zinzag got caught in the contradiction that she embarrassingly read a thing that was in his book from Frederick Douglass, that power can seize nothing without power, and so on and so forth. You know,
without demand,
and asked him about, hey, you guys didn't make any demand of Kerry, since that's obviously who you're going for when you tell the people, or you tell Nader not to go, and therefore you're endorsing Kerry. That's what you're doing, but you're not making any demand of him. So Zinzag, caught with that contradiction, bumbles all over himself. Now Chomsky gets defensive and says, I don't talk to Kerry. We can't make a demand on them. Well, you're voting for them.
That's right.
If you're voting for them and going to go through that process, that means that you are making some kind of allegiance with him, and that he has something within his program that you align yourself with in some form. And from that standpoint, for those involved in bourgeois politics, the way it's supposed to work out is that if you are willing to give me support by pulling that lever for you, then I have certain things that you agree upon, and I pledge to fulfill them. So then within the bourgeois concept, you have a right to demand that he fulfills it. What, Chomsky, are you asking him to fulfill?
Also,
40,000 more troops in Iraq.
There it is.
That's the real world. Your demand is a perpetuation of more imperial struggle for the ruling class, not against the ruling class, because you're voting for a component and an administrator for the ruling class. You're pulling of the lever. It's not an anti-imperialist struggle when you pull that lever for those who are defenders of the imperial system. You're fulfilling their program. You're aligning with them. That's the real world.
That's it. That's it.
All this other stuff is hocus pocus. No matter how you know defensive you get, and you try to frame it in some other direction.
Well, you know, first of all, let's just go back to the roots here and deal with who is Mr. Chomsky. The good professor, on a more convivial day, may tell you about some of his fantasies that he is an anarchist. But wait a minute. Anarchists don't vote. Oh, well, never mind. Let's continue. So what does he say? Now, this is a college professor here, a master in linguistics. What is there that would make one vote? What is there that would make one vote for one or the other candidate? Listen to what he says. There are some differences between the candidates. He says this and expects to be taken seriously. Some differences. Well, you're a damn professor. Why don't you articulate those differences? What are the actual differences? Okay. Since there really are none that he can articulate, you create. What you can't articulate, you create. Okay, so what's the difference? Well, one is extreme and one is less extreme. This is absolutely shameful.
But this is the same thing that Lakoff is doing out of Berkeley, another university professor.
Another liberal.
Getting caught up in these metaphors and sound bites and so on and so forth.
No, I was just going to say, I didn't know Chomsky could talk that loud, man. You know, always mumbling and shit.
That's right, but he had to put a little bird chest out when he got caught. And at least Amy did ask him a couple of questions. See, that's the other thing about an interview. But here's the other thing. You know, here's a dude, well, he's mumbling because he just got recently made a fool of himself. Remember, Chomsky supported Chalabi in Iraq. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The CIA.
But this is just demoralized.
Oh, he's gone. He's finished.
Well, a lot of them have been finished.
No, you know.
The whole point is that as long as they're not critiqued and bludgeoned properly.
Some people still will have illusions.
Some people. Right. He's still one of the icons in the whole little KPFA liberal world. Oh, don't please. Don't. He's without a doubt regarded quite, even by Lane Amy. She used him for the pitch time. So even though, she definitely did ask him some good questions and stuff like that, and obviously took it further than Neil Cohen, sisters and brothers, don't be confused. The reality is that she also used this interview in pitch time to get donations and stuff. That is also pulling the lever for what he's an advocate for. That's the real world. Here, Chomsky before... this is Chomsky before Amy asked about Nader. So I intentionally did this to, you know, because he didn't know that she was going to ask him about this whole Nader thing. So, of course, he went on his normal track of defiance against the ruling class and the wretchedness of this system and stuff before getting caught in a little rat trap, you know, later down the road. But I wanted you to hear what he was saying in the contradiction so that when he's saying this stuff now, which he said first,
it's tough talk.
It's in proper perspective. Check this out.
There are serious problems here. One problem is an almost total dissolution, disappearance of the basis for a democratic society. I mean, if we compare, say, this election with elections in, say, the second biggest country in the hemisphere, Brazil, we ought to be ashamed of ourselves. They have actual elections where there are issues and where they can elect some mass popular organizations that can elect as president someone from their own ranks. You know, managed background as a peasant, steel worker, union organizer, no higher education, very impressive figure, against far higher barriers than exist here. I mean, here we have a thing called an election, which is a choice between two men, both born to great wealth and political influence, went to the same fancy private schools, same elite university, joined the same secret society where you train people to be members of the ruling class, can run because they're funded by pretty much the same concentrations of private power, both understand that the election is supposed to keep away from issues. These are run by the PR industry in a way designed to keep the public out of it by focusing on what they call qualities. Is he a leader, a nice guy? Does he sigh? You know, that kind of thing. That's what the campaign is. Very few people know where they stand. In fact, there was a Gallup poll about a week ago where voters were asked why they're voting for Bush or Kerry. That was quite striking. I mean, one of the choices of the many choices was their stand on issues, you know, their agenda, policies. It's around 10%. And if you'd ask those people, they would have known. And that's the way it's supposed to be. This is a symbol of something extremely serious. In fact, on issue, this is a very well-polled country. We know a lot about people's attitudes and opinions. They are mostly off the agenda. They're not discussed. They're radically different from the elite consensus. And they just don't enter into the political system. That's a major problem. And the attitude's not bad. I mean, there's lots of... alongside of this, there's a very high level of activism. Now, maybe higher than ever. It's disorganized. It's the way this country is. Everything's broken up, disorganized. Nobody knows what's happening on the other side of town and so on. But there's plenty going on. Way more than in the past.
Well, part of the reason why things are disorganized amongst people activating against this system is cats like you who perpetuate confusion and stuff and blur the glass line in issues and stuff. You know, he talks about how in this country people should be ashamed of themselves because in other countries they're actually having actual elections. You know, and union organizers can be elected into office and so on and so forth. But here it's all a sham, you know, where the elections here are designed to keep people away. And it's run by the PR industry. And then he goes into how Kerry and Boy George served the same elite ruling class and went to the same elite university and on and on and on. So he was saying all of this stuff actually before the whole Nader thing got off and, you know, he got his ass exposed and got all defensive and then basically started saying things that were in contradiction to what you had heard him previously say. Now all of a sudden, one's extreme and one's less extreme. He started off basically saying that they're working in tandem. It's just Batman and Robin, you know. But when he gets caught saying, "Well, look, if one's Batman and one's Robin, and you're not realizing that they're working in tandem together after all the stuff that you said and seeing how they've worked together and swinging down and driving in cars together, then you must be the Joker because you're trying to confuse people about the reality." Then he puffs up, you know, but this shows this is happening because these cats are demoralized and don't really believe in the masses of class conscious people raising up that iron fist at the end of the day and smashing down the capitalists. And basically then at that point making our demand to the Boy Georges of the world, "Get on your knees before we execute you." That's going to be the demand. Or do you want to die up, you know, where you stand in? That's how it's going to work out. But since they don't have faith in that, since they don't have confidence in that, since they don't have any kind of true belief in that day coming, then they get caught up in what Michael Parente and Jeff Cohen and all of these other clowns basically are propagandizing you to believe that your neighbor who is aligning himself with the ruling class in a liberal frame of a mind and another one who's aligning himself with the ruling class in a conservative frame of mind are not confused working class people. They're both right. We're all in this together on the road to hell.
There's no qualitative difference. This is something I ran into at WPFW when I was in Washington. I said, well, there's really no difference between, the Republicans and the Democrats at this juncture. That's why they're so neck and neck, because the population can't see a difference. So since, oh, no, you can't, there's a difference. Of course they're different. They're different people, different DNA. You know, one's taller than the other. When we say there's no difference, let's be clear. There is no qualitative, programmatic difference in what they are right now in front of people proclaiming to do. There is no difference.
Let me just break it down to Soulsville. Basically, the L.A. cops, in a way the L.A. cops run and operate, their little militaristic squads in L.A., that's where SWAT started, and how they deal with the black communities, the Latino communities, so on and so forth, is different than the way the cops operate in New Orleans, or let's say a place like New Mexico and stuff, where it's more rural and stuff like that. They don't have the same type of particular death squads per se that they do in a lot of these big cities. But they're still working and operating under the same banner to serve the interests of the ruling class within this society. So the fact that you can have Gates types, you know, remember Gates out of L.A. and, you know, the whole no-knock law and the war on drugs really getting crystallized there, and the whole militarization of the police and stuff like that. And then you can go to another place in the country and see the cops not in that same type of militaristic mode. Does not mean that they're still not serving the same particular class. That's the real world that Chomsky and these guys, when they analyze or father figureize, liberal, quote unquote, Kerry, who's basically within that model, a soft imperialist or a hard imperialist in the model of Boy George, that they don't want you to view. Now, last up, to show how this thing wraps up, Amy asked Chomsky the extremeness that he thinks Boy George represents. Now, of course, this is not in order, but you heard the start off where he's basically defending Kerry and saying, Nader, don't run, and pull the lever for Kerry. That's in essence what he was doing. Because he was saying one was less extreme than the other, and we know he was talking about Kerry, even though he didn't want to come out and say it. Then at the beginning of the show that I played second, he was basically outlining how wretched both of the systems or both of the parties were, and how they basically work in tandem. Now, last, this is what he has to say about the extremeness that he thinks Boy represents. Check this out.
Is the extremism you think George Bush represents?
Well, they happen to be, both domestically and internationally, a very extremist group of radical reactionary nationalists. I mean, domestically, they are very publicly committed to dismantling and destroying the whatever there is of progressive legislation and social welfare and so on. That's the achievements that have been won, and they're not zero, by popular struggles over the past century. And they get rid of them. And they virtually say so, I see. Internationally, they are calling for dominating the world by military force. they are carrying out some of the things that are less talked about or more dangerous. They're carrying out what's called transformation of the military forces, a vast escalation of offensive military power, which is militarization of space is a major part of it, which are designed explicitly to give the U.S., them, that means, the power to attack and destroy any part of the world without warning, unannounced. Now, maybe they don't talk about it here, but they do elsewhere. I mean, that has led, predictably, to a vast increase, maybe a tripling, of Russian offensive military capacity, with new missile systems aimed at the United States, put on automated control, which is like asking for...
That's enough. You know, all this babbling now about what Boy George is doing and stuff. You know, so 1 minute he's talking about how both parties are working in tandem, which they are, because they're serving in the same way the police are, the same class forces. And he outlined that quite rightly. But then, when he gets hit with the contradiction about, well, why are you pulling the lever for the cops in New Mexico, you know, metaphorically, then all of a sudden he gets all puffed out of shape. And now he's talking about how Boy George's administration is dismantling the world. Not the IMF World Bank programs that right. Kerry supports. Not the WTO that Kerry supports. Not the School of the Americas that Kerry supports. Not the effective death penalty anti-terrorism bill, which was a precursor to the Patriot Act, which Clinton put into law and came up with and Kerry supported. Not all of these things, like the sanctions in Iraq, which dismantled out of existence over 1 million Iraqi people, that was obvious that Clinton and Kerry supported. So what he wants you to do is have pushed the same type of buttons that Lakoff was pushing earlier. In essence, he wants you to be ahistorical, not as critical on the system. And to do that, basically, is to commit suicide, because we live in a society where we're trying, in a world, where we're trying to get a clean cup of water. We have a ruling class that is not concerned if we have available a clean cup of water. It becomes clear at that point, when you have a segment of society whose interest is not in a clean cup of water for humanity, that segment of society has to go. Otherwise, we all go. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up with Slave tonight. It's clear that Lakoff to Chomsky to Howard Zinzag are basically playing apology music, accommodationist music. But for those of us who still have the blood of the slave on revolt running through our veins, we must continue to play our rebel music. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out.